Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. We're kicking off a new segment here on Center Stage titled 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. He's going to be the new Dr. Oz of Center Stage. He will try to help us find our way to optimal health through answering our health and medical questions. If you have an interest in getting healthier, building a stronger immune system, losing weight, or just want to know more about a specific medical condition, you have tuned into the right show. Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez is medical director and co-founder of International BioCare Hospital and Medical Center in Tijuana, Mexico, and is an internationally acclaimed and widely respected physician with a successful academic career. He decided a quarter of a century ago to enter the field of nutritional, immune, and integrative therapies. He is one of the most recognized experts in the integrative medicine world and has devoted his time and experience to bringing together advanced and high-tech medical achievements. Y'all, that's quite a bio. Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome to Center Stage Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. Good evening, Doctor. How are you?
Good evening. Thank you. I'm delighted to listen to you and to be on your show, just delightful and thankful.
Wonderful. You know, I was reading over your website today and was quite impressed at the different treatments that you all offer at your hospital. Can you give us an idea of some of the treatments that you all do over there that we wouldn't find here in the States?
Well, let me begin with something which is very, very important. Right now, if you look at everybody around you, wherever you are right now, you have to realize that most people, the majority of people, are going to die because of a chronic degenerative disease. What is that? That is a disease that starts within ourselves. We help a lot. We many times pay to get that disease. We help it all along, and then we die from it. And this is going to kill perhaps 70% of people. In other words, 7 out of 10 people. Not only that, the big problem, or the other big part of the problem, is that before this disease kills us, it's going to be lingering around. It's going to use up all our financial resources, all our energy. Is going to drain our loved ones because they have to take care of us, et cetera, et cetera. So these diseases are literally changing the face of the world. Like, for example, if you go back, and you don't have to go too far, I'm not talking about history, I'm talking about our lifetime memory. I mean, if we just look around what we used to eat and what medicine used to be like 50 years ago, there's going to be a big difference. I mean, between what we do today and what was done only 50 years ago, it's a huge difference. And if you go 100 years back, it seems like you're talking of a total different world. Mm-hmm. But 100 years ago was probably the time where your mothers or grandmothers were running around and doing their life, et cetera, and going about their everything, every daily life. So we're not talking about history or prehistory here. We're talking about just recent changes that we have produced in our lifestyle that has produced disease, inflammation, chronic damage. And what was my frustration, and that's what brought me where I am today, my frustration was that every time you go to the doctor with any of these diseases, and let me mention briefly which diseases I'm talking about, because that's going to clarify a lot of things. Like, for example, we talk about heart disease or vascular disease. What's vascular disease? Well, that's strokes and for example, diabetic ulcers in the legs, this type of thing, circulatory problems, diabetes itself, which is now running rampant among our people. Or high blood pressure, which, again, if you just look around and ask how many people around you have high blood pressure, Alzheimer's, things that we are very afraid of, or Parkinson's disease, these neurological diseases that really frighten us because they just don't kill us. They're going to make us miserable for many years. And if you think of all of these things that I'm mentioning, and I should include in the same group, cancer, if you think about this for a few seconds, the frightening thing is that when you go to the doctor is going to tell you, okay, we did these tests, now we know you have this problem, now you have to take this medication, and when you ask how long am I going to take the medication for, the doctor is going to say forever. In other words, you're never going to get cured. This is something you're stuck with and that you will never be able to reverse, or so they tell you. You will never be able to reverse, so you will have to take this medication. And then this medication has side effects, so probably after some time you are going to have to add other medications. And this is going to be on and on, and it's not strange to see people that take 12, 15 tablets every day or even more. You see, so that's the importance of all this. And when I was looking at things, and I was, and it's not only me, it's really a group of people that rebel of how am I going to end up in my days just being pulled in a wheelchair or having somebody to move me around or with all these critical problems, and I'm never going to be cured. All I know is that I'm going to wait and wait and wait until one day I finally die, and then I get rid of all my problems. And this was not acceptable in many ways. And when you review all these circumstances, you say, well, you know what? This diseases we didn't see a very short time ago. I mean, if you ask your grandmother, or even your mother, I mean, were you ever worried about osteoporosis? Your grandmother even might ask you, what is that? What are you talking about? If you ask again your grandmother and you say, how many people in your family had high blood pressure? Might be one or two, but right now it's everybody. I mean, suffice to say that in the United States, people about 65 years old, probably 70-80% of them take some sort of a medication for a chronic problem. So that tells us a lot. And when you review all these circumstances, then you see that there's only one way out. And the one way out is that we have to stop and think and review what we're doing with our lives and with our bodies and then start making changes, because that's going to be the only way to help reverse all these conditions. The help is within us. There is no other possibility. And you can go to your doctor, to your well-respected physician, and say, doctor, am I going to take this for how long? Because that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, you go to the doctor, you have an infection, they give you a pill, you take it for so long, and then the infection is gone, and you're free to go and continue with your life. You just go on with your life. But that's not true with all these diseases. So what do we have to do? We have to stop and review everything and get on reverse and say, what am I doing? I have to go backwards in time to review what people were doing before this time and why were they healthier, because they were actually healthier.
Okay, let's start right there then. So that said, your body tells you when something is wrong. And is it the situation that we're not paying attention when our bodies are saying something is wrong? If we're putting the wrong things into it, our bodies is going to give us some type of reaction, correct?
You're absolutely right. Our bodies always tell us what's happening. Our bodies always will be telling us day by day what is wrong with our health, or telling us that something is not working properly. And what we have to do is pay attention. And you know, and I know very well, that as you grow older, our bodies become more talkative, because there are more situations that our bodies are going to be telling us about. And what we have to do is stop and listen. And yes, we all of a sudden feel tired. All of a sudden, if not tired, we don't have the energy we used to have. We used to run and do errands. And then one day we wake up and then people tell us, oh, why don't we go to this movie? Why don't we go to this place? And we say, no, I think I'd rather stay home. And it's not because we love the quietness of our house. It's not because of any of this. It's because, if we're completely honest, because we don't feel like doing it. We're we don't have the energy or the stamina or the interest to do it. And we many times interpret this wrongly as aging. Then we say, no, you know what, I think I'm getting older because I'm not interested in doing this, I'm not interested in doing that anymore. We start walking slower, and because we walk slower, we walk less. That's very important. And we have so much help in our lives, and we have so many possibilities to motorize our movements, from the car to elevators to you name it, washing machine, etc., that we hardly do any physical activity. And we have to start reviewing all that and say, no, I have to keep this body in shape. I have to keep moving my body. I have to be doing a little bit of exercise and activity. And once I was reading, for example, something that really caught my attention of a movie star who they were asking him, what you do to stay in good shape? And then he says, you know, I watch my son, and I saw, and we all can see that. If you mm-hmm. have a young person in the family, he says, I saw my son going upstairs and downstairs for every little bit, every little thing he could think of, and he would run upstairs and really rush down and run to the sidewalk to get something and do things really fast. And we tend to do it slower and slower. We might not notice it, but it's going to take a toll. We many times say, oh, since you're going that way, could you bring me this? Right. We don't even move within the house. And we have to be more conscientious about that.
One so we got to get moving.
Yes. One of the great things that I'm looking at now is some of these wristbands that you put on, and we'll measure how many steps you walk during the day.
Right.
And it's a very simple gadget, but it's going to tell you how many steps you walk during the day. And we should be walking around 5,000 to 6,000 steps a day and to be healthy and to be in better shape. And there are even studies, like, for example, of states like Colorado. Colorado has higher number of steps a day as an average in their population. People in Colorado walk around an average of 7,000 versus other states in the East Coast that walk very little, about 4,000 steps. That's 2,000 steps difference. But
okay.
If you look at the health statistics, those 2,000 steps a day do make a difference.
Okay, so we got to get moving. So we know now that we got to exercise. We got to stop, you know, moving slower, and we got to move faster. We got to get moving. Another thing, then, Dr. Rodrigo, I've heard that anything white is pretty much bad for you. Can you clarify that tonight? I've heard that like white sugar, white flour, white bread, white rice, white potatoes are all bad. We should stay away from white stuff. Is that correct?
That is very correct, and let me tell you why. And there's a very simple, very, very simple explanation. I have a dear friend of mine, Marine Salaman, who always said, God made foods in perfection. Mm-hmm. And yes, foods were made in perfection. I mean, God didn't make any mistake with them. He did them perfectly all right. But then we intervene and we make changes. And one of the things that we have had is this fad with white food. White sugar, white flour would be the most important ones.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, which is also white, is salt, but we're going to talk about that later. But we're talking about white sugar and white bread. What is the problem with white? Well, people say, you know what, and I get this question all the time. I love people asking questions. Because I always, my motto is, there is no way you're going to get an answer if you don't have a question first.
Right.
So I love people that are inquiring, people that call or email and say, you know what, I have this question, I have this doubt, etc. That tells me that person is motivated, is proactive, wants to do something. Well, and many people say, for example, doctor, what supplement is good if I'm diabetic? What is a good supplement if I take sugar or flour? What is this? And you say, you know what, the answer is, probably one of the most important answers would be chromium. chromium is a mineral, and that's in many plants. Plants take it from the soil, and it's in the plant. So when we eat those plants, we should be eating the carbohydrate plus the chromium. But chromium is brown. And that's exactly what gives the color to many foods that are carbohydrate-rich. Think, again, if we talk to the audience and they think for a second about what foods are brown, are most sweets. Honey is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar naturally is brown.
Mm-hmm.
Wheat is naturally brown. I mean, if you take a fistful of wheat grains in your hand, it's going to be brown. And many things are with this color, many natural honeys and these type of things, which means God made that food in perfection. It put the carbohydrate with its good amount of the supplement you need, which is the chromium. When we bleach it, when we polish the wheat, when we get rid of the color, we're getting rid of the chromium. So you get only the carbohydrate with no defense, with no any possibility to handle it correctly. You see, so that's not a good thing. Food should be consumed the way God made them, and as close as God made them as possible, which means the less cooking, the less temperature, the less everything we do, the better off we're going to be. And I always say there's a safety valve, there's a safety situation with food when you're cooking. That's always a good idea because it always has a safety valve, which is cooking with water. What do I mean by cooking with water? I mean if you make a broth, if you make a soup, if you steam, if you blanch, if you simmer, all those things, poach, all those things are going to be very safe in terms of temperature of the food. Why? Because the water is going to get to a certain temperature, which is very safe, and then turns into steam. From then on, the temperature will not keep on rising. Whereas when you're cooking in oils, this can be 3-4 times the temperature, and that could not only ruin the nutritional capacity of the food, but even change the food into something that's not as healthy.
Okay. So when we spoke of the fact that most of these white things have been bleached, as far as white potatoes, does that same rule still apply, that white potatoes is not healthy?
No, because when you eat, it's not the same rule, and I'm glad you brought it because when you talk about carbohydrates, for example, if you talk of a white potato, let's talk about a banana. They are very safe. They're very safe. They're complex carbohydrates.
Okay.
They're good carbohydrates. That's the way they were made. A white potato was made white, and we can eat it. But white sugar was never created. So that's not a natural substance. White potato is. And these are complex carbohydrates. Let me give you something, a rundown that I think for the audience is important. What's a complex carbohydrate? A carbohydrate can be very simple as sugar, which means it's going to go into your system, right into the bloodstream, and create a spike of sugar in your blood. That spike produces a response, an immediate response of insulin. So your body is going to react immediately with a huge amount of insulin to control that spike of sugar because you're eating a refined sugar. When you have a complex carbohydrate like the white potato or like the banana, these are more complex substances, and they're going to be digested little by little, and the carbohydrate is going to enter the blood at a pace. It's going to have a pace. It's going to go little by little. So the pancreas is going to react with insulin, yes, but not in an acute emergency way. It's just going to be very gentle, producing insulin that's going to let us use our carbohydrates in a good way. So complex carbohydrates like these fruits or anything like this is perfectly acceptable.
Okay. Let's talk about altering foods, because we know a lot is going on with genetically modified foods right now. Is there anything that, you know, that you found to be a problem with genetically modified food, which is pretty much everything we're eating today? But what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I don't like it. I definitely don't like it. I know that the idea of what should we eat and we should not eat is a little bit complicated for many people. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, I'm going to give you a simple rule. I have what's called the 100-year rule. And that means if the food you're about to eat was available 100 years ago, you're probably safe.
Oh.
And if you were to have a wholesome bread or a salad or one of the time-honored foods that I absolutely love is barley, all these things, you're safe. But if you're going to eat something that didn't exist 100 years ago, be careful. And what wasn't available 100 years ago is anything that's in a pack, anything that's in a can, everything that's been microwaved, or foods that come out of a factory. And genetically modified foods, I don't have any evidence to tell you it's not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any. But my instinct tells me stay away from it. It cannot be good. I cannot believe that it's safe and rational to get a corn that when you put the seed, it will not produce corn again, or beans, or whatever. You see, these genetically modified foods, they give you the seed from any of these corporations. You put it, you create a crop, but when you take the grains from that crop, you cannot reproduce the same plant. So you wonder what's really it, you see, and I don't definitely don't feel safe with them, and we cannot tell as of today whether the foods that we're eating are genetically modified or not. I think that has been a constant battle from consumers, but I normally advise people, okay, go for organic. You know, something that's also very safe, eat local foods. And this is the perfect time of the year. We're beginning the time of the year when we can have all these local farmers markets where we can go and buy things that are locally grown by people we know, by people, by our own neighbors. And that is also very safe. It's very convenient. It's very everything. It's cheaper, you name it. It has many advantages, and we're going to be eating better and better and better.
You know, one thing I was wondering about, and you're speaking of things that happened 100 years ago versus now, you know, back in the day, every other person you know wasn't on kidney dialysis or suffering from cancer. So is that possibly connected to what we're eating? You know, all the autoimmune diseases that were not present, you just didn't see this many people with Parkinson's disease and MS like you do today. Is that possible? Could it possibly be part of our diet?
I truly believe that if we change the way we eat today and stop smoking today as a nation, if you did those two things, I'm sure that we would drop a rate of cancer probably at least by half in the next 10 years. That's how much I feel about food in our lives. And all you have to do, and I would invite all our listeners to begin tomorrow with a piece of paper and pencil and write down what they had for breakfast and what they had for lunch and what they had for dinner. Mm-hmm. Check the times. The time of the day when we eat is important. Our bodies are more better recipient of food during the first part of the day, and we should have a lighter dinner, an early dinner, but lighter. We should have better breakfast, better lunch, smaller dinner. But if people start doing that as a little exercise for, let's say, a week, they're going to realize that a lot of the foods that they're eating, they don't have to be a doctor to know, they're not safe, they're not healthy. I mean, every time we stop at a fast food place, there's nothing I can tell you. This is good. This is advisable. You see, I mean, if you told me I went to a fast food place, what would you advise me to have? Well, not even the salad bar is really great. You see, because most of the time it's only lettuce, and we know that lettuce is probably one of the vegetables that has the least properties, not even fiber. You see, but if we go to multi-grain breads and we go to, I don't have anything against dairy products and good quality of dairy products, organic preferably all the time, mm-hmm. and free-range poultry and these things, I mean, people will feel the difference. And the ironic thing in all this situation is that I feel sometimes that why do I have to explain people that better food makes better function? If I gave you a car, if I gave you a Porsche today and I said, look, I'm going to give you this very expensive car, just go and fill it up because barely has any gas in it. You're going to go to the gas station and you're going to get the best fuel money can buy because it's a Porsche, because it's a luxury car. It's not just an old junk thing. It's a very good car that you want in great performance. So you're going to buy the best fuel money can buy, and you know you're going to pay for the same amount of fuel, for the same gallon of fuel, you know you're going to be paying more money. And the same with food. When we are buying our food, we have to buy better foods because that's going to what really eventually will change a lot of the things that are happening around us. I mean, in this time and age, we cannot get a gun and make a revolution because we want better food. But we can take our checkbooks to the places that we feel provide us with better foods. So if we start doing that, then a lot of people will start changing. Actually, that tendency happens today as we speak, because in a lot of places you're going to see more and more the word organic, the word free range, the words no hormones. All these things are happening because of people's pressure. People are beginning to be a much better consumers of food, and that's going to provide the changes that we need to be healthier. And mainly, I mean, we might be too far gone in many cases, but what about our children? And I see many patients here. I see many people with cancer, with heart disease, with degenerative problems, and I always ask them, you already have this problem. What about your children? What about your grandchildren? Wouldn't it be good if you take a good message, a good experience out of this, and then you say, we're going to be making changes for them, teach them how to be healthier and function better? That would be an absolutely fantastic thing, and then not everything was wasted.
Wow. And you know what? Next we're going to ask Dr. Rodriguez about color in our diet. How important is color in our diet? If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. That's a new segment we're going to be doing on center stage from time to time. We're going to be talking about health and how to get healthier, how to get to our optimal health through exercise, diet, vitamins, that type of thing. Dr. Rodriguez is going to help us with that. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They can be found on the web at AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. If you got a question for Dr. Rodriguez, get on the phone lines. Dial us up at 347-850-8390 and then press 1. Again, the number to call if you have a question for Dr. Rodriguez tonight, give us a call at 347-850-8390. This is the freest medical attention you're going to get this year probably with all that we got going on in the medical field here in the States. So Dr. Rodriguez has said he's open to answering your questions. So if you have any type of medical question, anything about exercise, diet, Give Dr. Rodriguez a call tonight at 347-850-8390. Dr. Rodriguez, before I took a break there, I was talking about color in diet. How important is it that we get all the colors that we can get into our diet, yellows and the purples and the, you know, oranges and the reds? How important is that?
Okay, the colors are very important as long as we're talking of natural colors. In other words, foods that are rich in color are normally very good for us. They're cancer preventive. They're heart disease preventive. They have a lot of good things. There are substances called like lycopene, which is what makes tomatoes red, but many other substances that help not only tomatoes, but peppers, and you have them in all sorts of colors, and fruits with yellows and oranges and all these beautiful colors. And the more colors you eat, the better off you're going to be, because you're complementing your diet with a lot of these substances that work as vitamins and that can make very healthy changes in our body. Many of them are antioxidant. Many of them have enzyme activity. In other words, they help to break down substances or fight disease. So they're absolutely great. However, food coloring should be avoided. Artificial food coloring is a problem because there are many studies, for example, that prove, particularly in children, that they're going to make them, give them anxiety and give them behavioral problems. And with all also, you might not be able to sleep well, etc. And again, if you look around, we're literally assaulted by all these chemicals in our food supply. We have all these artificial coloring, sweeteners, flavoring, all these things that should be out of our life. Again, if you go to the 100-year rule, they don't belong to a good diet 100 years ago. But if you go to the market, and again, I have to refer again to a farmer's market. If you go there, you're going to see how many beautiful things people have. And yes, the more colors you put in your food, the better off you're going to be.
Okay, we're going to go to the phone lines. We're going to pick up area code 417-317. Good evening. You're talking with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Rodriguez, I was wondering if you are familiar with the gut and psychology syndrome.
I didn't get the – if I'm familiar with what?
It's a diet that is called the gut and psychology syndrome, and it was developed by a neurosurgeon, and it's something that we have been following, and I was wondering if you knew anything about this. I actually developed severe anxiety and insomnia and a number of other symptoms about a year ago, and I think that I realized I had become allergic to gluten, and so we have been on this diet that was developed by this neurosurgeon, and what I'm wondering is it's quite a protocol in order to heal the gut, because she said that this is the result of a leaky gut and has from damage by wheat, by this hybrid wheat, and I was wondering if in your hospital, if you had a protocol that would help to heal this a little bit quicker, and if you knew anything about that, about me suddenly becoming allergic to gluten and things like that. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, you're talking about a very, very, unfortunately, again, one of the common things that we're living with in the last few years, which is gluten intolerance, leaky gut syndrome, all these things that are mainly, and we go back again, they were produced by a faulty diet that you had in the past. And in many times, you probably were helped by the use of antibiotic therapy. The use of antibiotic or the abuse of antibiotics nowadays is really huge. And I always ask this question, what do anybody believe are the chances for a baby being born today to get to their first birthday without any pediatrician giving them any antibiotics? It's really, really low. I mean, we give our children antibiotics, and we use them for everything. And this produces a lot of damage in the intestinal flora. Then you add to that a diet that's very poor in fiber. And children and youngsters, teenagers, for example, and we know it very painfully well, do not like vegetables. They don't like anything that has fiber in it. They like chicken nuggets, or they like a hot dog, or they like a hamburger. But everything is very poor in fiber. And the lack of fiber with a very poor intestinal bacterial flora is going to be producing a damage to the lining of the intestine. The lining of the intestine is like velvet. It has all these villi, are called, these little things that will make the food go through the bowel and that will only let good things enter the cell and bad things stay out of them. But if we don't have enough fiber in the diet in our younger years and we don't have good bacteria, these villi become smaller and smaller, and then the content of the gut becomes in touch with the cell and produces all these reactions. Food intolerance, it produces the leaky gut because a lot of the products are going to enter the gut and the blood directly and give you all sorts of symptoms. People feel achy, feel sick, do not feel good. People feel like if they very much like if they had a flu, something like that, they're going to have all these symptoms. They don't feel well. They get dizzy, etc. And all these symptoms, of course, will have to be counteracted by a total different diet. And you were mentioning beans. Beans is a good way to help them. And, yes, we work in the hospital with sort of a syndrome. And in the hospital, because we have the advantage of being able to put a patient on a real intensive medical regime, in many cases we put them on intravenous nutrition while we help the bowel to be healed and help the replenish the intestinal flora and help with some of these fiber derivatives to help to replenish all the function and the villi and the quality of the intestinal lining so it starts working normally. And unfortunately, it's a problem that we're seeing more and more, and particularly in young people. Probably those of us that are my age or let's say 50 years or older, we are very safe. But people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s right now, we're seeing a lot of that problem, and their lives can be, and you probably have lived with it, can become very miserable with a lot of symptoms and a lot of suffering and pain and everything, and they can hardly eat and enjoy their lives.
But you all can treat that type of condition at BioCare Hospital, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, we because one of the things that we do at the hospital, the BioCare Hospital, is with everything that I have said, of course, when I see a patient, the first thing I want to do is I want to bring back a lot of these things that we are missing. I want to give back good nutrition. I want to give back good essential fatty acids. I want to recreate a good intestinal flora. I want to recreate a good intestinal function. I want to recreate all these things. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to working on everything I can so people can start helping themselves from within, recreating all the structures and all the function that they should have. And this, in turn, is going to improve immunity, is going to improve performance, is going to make away with a lot of the symptoms that they have so they feel stronger, much more functional, they feel more energetic. And all this is going to change the way they live and the way they handle their disease, to the point where they are going to regain, and that's the goal. We have to regain the full control of your body from within so you go back to a normal life. You have to move on to a normal life. The idea is you have to go back to work, you have to go back to doing your things, you have to go to be able to move around, to sleep well, to function well, and to be around the people that you love and enjoy their company. Not being sick, not being on a couch, not being in the bathroom, not being in any of these things. So the whole idea is to continue in a program that's going to rebuild and restore all the normal functions so you regain full control of your life.
Colin, does that answer your question?
Yes, I was wondering if I could ask him one more point there. Since I have developed this, I was 45 when I actually developed it, and I've also dealt with psoriasis and where my foot would break out and weep and things like that. And I was wondering, this Carnivora, which I actually heard your program with Lindsay Williams earlier today, and he had suggested this, and I'm wondering, would that product help me in terms of dealing with a high level of toxicity, which I think I am dealing with because of my leaky gut and my poor flora, bowel flora? Do you think that would help me to heal faster if I took the Carnivora?
I would think so. If you continue on your diet and you continue on medical care, and if you do Carnivora is a powerful immune stimulant, and yes, it could help you to go faster in your quest and at least to control a lot of the opportunistic infections that develop because of the same condition that you have. So yes, I would stand behind it.
Could I ask you one more thing here? Is there anything else that you could think of? Because I know many people who are struggling with this. This is becoming really just like an epidemic. And I'm wondering, do you have any suggestions for people who can't attend your hospital of something they could do? Besides, like, I've been taking, like, probiotics that are like therapeutic strength probiotics and things like that. Do you have any suggestions in addition to the Carnivora?
Well, one thing that it's really can work wonderful things for this sort of syndrome is barley. Okay, mm-hmm. And barley, you can make bread with it. Actually, in the hospital, all our bread has 30% barley. We make salads with barley. We cook the barley and then we mix it with, we produce a dressing. It's very good, very flavor food. If you contact me, I will be happy to send you the recipe. But barley is something that you can look for around and get barley bread or barley flour. You can mix it, for example, if you're going to make some bread. It is a wonderful thing. And I would make sure. One of the big advantages of barley is that, contrary to what happens to many grains, with many grains, when you make, for example, regular wheat into white wheat, you're removing the kernel, you're removing the bran, and then you just get stuck with the pure carbohydrate, with the refined carbohydrate that's in the center of the grain. With barley, you cannot do that. For some reason, this is a seed that's made with everything very mixed, very complex. So you cannot take the flour out of the grain or separate it from the bran. The bran is part of the seed. So every time you eat barley, you're eating everything you should be eating. There's no way you can make it any different, and that's really a blessing. Because even if you tried, you couldn't do it bad.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And if I was to contact your hospital or contact you further, is that possible?
Yes, if you want to contact me, I'll be very happy to talk to you. And you can remind me that we talked at the Kerry Hines show, and I'll be happy to talk to you. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Doctor. And I'd like to say, Kerry, I just discovered your program, and you have such a sweet spirit, and I'm going to be a regular listener. And thank you very much, Dr. Rodriguez.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. You know, Dr. Rodriguez, she brought up a good point about the gluten-free diet. That's something a couple years ago you didn't hear of, and now everybody's talking about a gluten-free diet. Are those healthy? And why would someone need to go to a gluten-free diet?
Okay, the first part of the answer, are they healthy? No, I don't think any diet that suppresses any specific part of food is a good diet. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you say a low carbohydrate diet or a fat and protein diet or this type of diet, I don't go with it. What's mm-hmm. happening with this gluten problem is that there is such a damage of the intestinal lining that these people have to go into very specific type of foods just not to get these symptoms, just not to trigger the pain or the discomfort that comes with food. So one of the things that they do is they avoid a lot of foods that contain gluten. And they, in some cases, they feel better. But I have seen many people that even with that, they do not really do better. They do not function well. And in some extreme cases, as I was telling you, we have to put them in a hospital and stop food altogether, do intravenous feeding while we rebuild the intestine. But in general, if you have to go to a diet that's going to suppress one normal part of food, you have a problem. And that problem has to be addressed. I absolutely agree with you.
So there's an underlining problem to going to a diet like that that you need to address rather than just stopping that particular food from entering your system. You need to address the problem first.
Absolutely correct. Yes, absolutely.
You know, another thing that I've seen a lot of issues, I can't decide one way or another because I know people well over 40 still doing it, but is birth control pills safe after a certain age, and what is a cutoff age for stopping the use of birth control pills? Are they even safe?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Okay, birth control, as far as we know with the pills nowadays, with the very small doses that we use, are safe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I always try to address with women is you're already taking an estrogenic load when you do that. Even though it's small, you're already taking it. So if you're on the pill, you have to have more careful about what other possible sources of estrogens you have.
Mm.
And for that, then you have to be more careful about organic foods, particularly organic dairy products, cheese, butter, milk, and organic eggs and chicken. And that's going to be a lot safer than continuing with the normal type of diet, because the normal type of diet and this other little bit might be too much, and that might be one of the reasons why we're looking at more and more breast cancer every year. So if we start watching that, and I think it's so simple to do it. And one of the big problems is we never want to stop to think, what can I do to be healthier? What can I do to live longer? What can I do to function better? And I think that's all important. I mean, if we're having a good, nice, enjoyable life, let's keep it that way. And if we have to make some changes in our life that we know are for the best, you're going to feel better. And you're going to function better. So it's a good thing that you avoid some of these things. Again, all these the hormones that might be added to the food supply. Another one. The next one is then also, what can I do for it? Well, you were talking about food coloring. Well,
mm-hmm.
all these food colors, all these natural food colors, like the food, like the carotenes in the carrot, or the lycopene in the tomatoes, or the other substances that color the peppers or the fruits and so forth, all of them have are going to help us to control this estrogenic burden. So let's see eat more of that, okay? And we know about cruciferous. We know about broccoli. We know about cauliflower, we know about Brussels sprouts, artichokes, all these things. Well, let's do a little bit more of those. I mean, let's be more conscientious about that. And if we're going to have a dinner, we might want to have an artichoke instead of a baked potato. That's going to reduce the calories, but and it's also going to work on our behalf. And there are two products that actually go against the estrogens in our body. In other words, they help to neutralize estrogens. And one of them is soy. And the other one is chickpeas, garbanzo beans. So if we eat more of those, we're also going to be in better shape.
But hasn't soy been linked to cancer?
No, it has been a misunderstanding with soy in particular.
Okay.
Soy has a substance. Let me explain. Soy has a substance that is similar to estrogens.
Okay.
But they are not estrogens. What happens is that when the body sees them in the body, it is misled to believe that you have estrogens and it will reduce your own production of estrogens. You see, so when we eat soy, we actually fool our bodies into believing that we have estrogens and we make less inside of our body. And that has been one of the possible explanations of why Oriental women have so little breast cancer. But chickpeas and garbanzo beans have a similar effect. And they're very inexpensive, and they're good foods. And if you like hummus, well, that's a good way to help your body also. And now the next and very important part about these things, it has been really shown that women that eat large amounts of animal protein, beef in particular, have higher levels of estrogen. Not necessarily because it's in the beef, which is in many cases, but because somehow it increases the production, the inner production of estrogens. And women that go more to the vegan type lifestyle have much lower amounts of estrogen. So if we're going to be on the pill, I would tend to a vegan diet. I would take all my colors in my food. I would probably use some of these substances that we're talking of, foods, like the cruciferous, like the Brussels sprouts and artichokes and broccoli and these things, and make sure that I don't have any estrogens in my food supply by checking the labels and making sure I'm having organic poultry, dairy products, etc., free of hormones. So if you do all that, then you're in good shape. Now, how long should we stay on the pill? Which was the other part of the question that's also very important. If you have women that tend to be on the vegan side of the spectrum, they tend to have much less problems with menopause.
Oh,
and which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I would let menopause go by before I would stop my pills, and particularly if you are sexually active. If not, you can leave them before that. And then if you go on this vegan tendency, if you do all these things that I'm talking about in terms of certain foods and certain lifestyle, you're going to see that you will have less and less need of hormones, because definitely I do not recommend anybody to use estrogens to counteract menopause, like Premarin and all these things that used to be. Actually, they're doing them less and less and less, and they're almost non-existent nowadays. And just 20 years ago, if you had menopause symptoms, they would give you that. But now they're going down and down. I'm using more the biocompatible hormones and taking a total different approach. But in general, I think that this is part of life.
Okay.
And unless we really have very serious problems, I would go for natural things to try to balance my condition, but not go for hormones, which could have a big health cost.
Okay. Yeah, we're down to our last hour in the show, and if you just tuned in, you come Center Stage tonight for the topic 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. If you have a question or a comment, get on the phone lines. Call us up at 347-850-8390. Dr. Rodriguez is answering your medical questions. It doesn't get much better than that, y'all. He is taking any question you may have on your diet, on a medical condition, on exercise, anything that's related to getting you to a healthier you, he is answering tonight. He is going to be the Dr. Oz of Center Stage. I love it, y'all. We're going to do this segment. We haven't decided how often, but we're going to do it probably once a month if Dr. Rodriguez is available, and try to answer all of your medical questions. So the new segment is titled 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. He's from Tijuana, Mexico, and he's with the BioCare Hospital there, where they do a lot of different treatments that we don't have here in the States. But we got to catch up because I got so many questions myself. I want to ask you, Doctor, let's talk about a lot of issues I've found out are connected to pH balance and yeast overgrowth. Can you kind of expound on that a little bit? So many things that women are dealing with, and men too, I understand, have to do with yeast overgrowth and with women, the pH balance being off. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, I'll be very happy to. And once again, when you start analyzing all these situations, all these things that happen to people, all these new things that we're looking happening to people. I mean, yeast overgrowth is another thing that we're seeing more and more and more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And pH balance and all these things. Every time you go back to these situations, the answer is going to be probably in a lot of these things that we already have mentioned.
Diet.
Let me give you one example. One of the big problems with intestinal flora is that we have a good flora that's produced through very complex, I mean really God-created mechanisms, because when we were born, we didn't have one single bacteria in that gut.
Mm.
In just a short period of time, our intestine is filled with all these bacteria, but to a limit. And that limit is that we have all the bacteria in the colon and absolutely no bacteria in the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing because, I mean, if you have a rotten apple, and you know the saying, if you have one rotten apple, that's going to rotten the whole bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And with this bacteria never happens. I mean, it's so well controlled, it's so magnificently done that we have all these good bacteria living in our colon, and they never go to the other part of the intestinal tract, which is a condition, which is a disease called translocation. It's called bacterial translocation.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have this problem hardly ever in our lives, but now we're seeing it more frequently. And again, it has to do with the undiscriminated and massive use of antibiotics that damages bacteria that are really good and helps bacteria that are not that good, that are what's called pathogenic. A pathogenic bacteria is a bacteria that can produce disease. A good bacteria is a bacteria that will not produce any disease. A good example of a good bacteria is bacteria that we have in our gut that take some food byproducts and produce vitamin K. And that's a good bacteria. You have something in your bowel that's going to be producing a vitamin that you need, so you don't have to go to the store and buy vitamin K. You're getting it from your own gut because of these good bacteria working for you. But on the other hand, we have a strand of very bad bacteria called Clostridia, and these Clostridia are anaerobic. They flourish in low oxygen, and they are very aggressive, and they can translocate very easy. In other words, they can go to parts of the bowel where they shouldn't be around and produce damage to the intestinal lining and produce a lot of the problems that we have mentioned, like leaky gut syndrome, like gluten problems, etc. And again, it has been shown that people that are basically meat eaters produce larger amounts of these bacteria. Why? Because the byproducts of digestion of meat help these bacteria to develop. Whereas if you are more on the vegan side of the spectrum, and I'm not saying you have to be vegetarian. I'm not endorsing it. Again, I feel that we were given all this diverse food supply for us to use, but we have to be smarter than just take one thing. And right now, we're eating only animal protein. I mean, when you go to dinner, you never ask people, what do you want to eat, period. You would ask, what do you want, fish, meat, or poultry? In other words, we define our food by the animal protein that's in it. And if you go to a Vietnamese restaurant, if you go to a Chinese restaurant, if you go to even a French restaurant, you might find a lot of options that do not contain any meat.
But isn't a lot of the meat that we eat filled with antibiotics? So a lot of these antibiotics that we're resistant to,
after a while, is from the meat. Absolutely. That makes things a lot worse because you don't have the quality of the meat. I mean, if you were to eat a free-roaming beef that was running around in the prairie and eating grass from the ground and having a nice life, etc., okay. But we're eating a beef that was risen in a very enclosed environment with a lot of individuals, one animal next to the other, and because of this closeness, they have to be given antibiotics so they don't get infected one with the other, and they have to be given hormone-like products to make them grow faster and grow more meat, etc., because we're buying food by the pound, not by quality. You see? And then we're not only eating a lot of protein, but we're eating bad protein. Like, for example, if you test the liver of any of these animals, you're going to see like antioxidant enzymes with should be in the liver are much lower than one in a free roaming animal. I mean, we all know, for example, about the big difference that you have in fat in a buffalo than beef. Beef probably has 10 to 20 times more fat than buffalo. And the big difference, this is an animal that's roaming and moving around. We talk a lot, for example, about South American beef, Argentinian, for example, or Brazilian. Well, the big difference is that they do not keep their animals in limited areas. They let them roam free because they have plenty of rain. And because of plenty of rain, they have plenty of grass, and they have all these animals roaming around and eating and so forth. That would be for them the most cost-effective way to raise their cattle. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this cattle has a different quality. And because one animal is not leaning against the other, the chances of them getting infected by any problem that one has are much more limited, so they have to use, or they're not forced to use, that many antibiotics.
Okay, we're going to have to move along pretty quickly now. Let's talk about someone sick versus someone that is healthy. I'm understanding that there is a big connection between depression and sickness and the will to live and getting better. Whether, you know, if you're depressed and sick and you don't have the will to go on, I'm understanding, based on something that I read, that you actually can deteriorate faster that way than if you're someone who has, you know, faith in a higher power and the will to go on. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. That's
really absolutely true.
It makes such a big difference. You know, I've seen people coming to the hospital that are seriously ill, but you see, as you said, the confidence in them, the confidence in them that there is a superior will that will tell when and how, and they do it. I remember distinctly a lady that I saw with colon cancer, very advanced. She came from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I remember I was talking with her, telling her about the blood work results and the x-rays and the whole thing. And I might have had a little bit of serious tone because this condition was very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking, and then all of a sudden she turns to me, almost smiling, and she tells me, "Doctor, don't take it so seriously." She says, "I know I'm going to go one day, but," and I remember her words distinctly because she says, "You know what? All my bills are paid. There's nothing I owe to anybody. So I'm ready and packed to go. Whenever God tells me, I'm leaving. I came here because my children want me to do something, and I trust you, and I'm going to do what you tell me," etc., etc. Well, this lady came for follow-up a year later, and a year later, and a year later. And I used to even joke about her condition with other physicians to say, look at this lady, look at these x-rays, look at this blood work. And they would say, "Oh, my God." And I said, "Well, forget it. She's been coming here for 5 years, and she doesn't seem to be going anywhere soon." But I was convinced that it was her confidence and her feeling, her good feeling about everything about her life. And she was always smiling, and she was always relaxed and so forth. And I always tell people, look, you don't have to be sick. You don't have to have a cancer to realize that it does make a difference. How many times we have had something that aggravates you, something that gives you a big worry, and all of a sudden, if you close your eyes and think of it, and then you ask yourself to relax and just forget about the problem for a minute, I many times tell people, go to the bathroom, shut the door, turn off the light, close your eyes, and start thinking of your body. Start thinking of your jaws, of your fist, of your neck. Let it relax. Let things flow. Let things change. And we all of a sudden realized that we were really uptight. We're not breathing properly. We're not functioning well. We're creating a problem ourselves, because we don't have that trust that things are going to be okay. We don't have that confidence that can make a huge difference. And that anguish, all that concern, is of course going to give us a lot of problems. And worse, of course, if not only we don't have it, but people that are terribly depressed. I know people that are terribly depressed, terribly frightened, and when I see them, I many times can tell this person is not going to do well. They're so depressed. They're so, they have really brought everything so much down that they can hardly move. They can hardly function. And we all have seen people like that. And again, you don't have to be in a hospital. You don't have to be with cancer. Many times we go to a friend's house, to a family member's house, and we see them just sitting, their head hanging literally because they don't even have the strength to keep it up. And this is literally killing people because they don't have the drive, they don't have the energy, they don't have the what it takes to say, I want to go, I want to keep on going, I want to conquer this problem. That's absolutely true. And I when I talk to patients, I always make emphasis on that. And I said, look, if you don't have confidence in God or whatever you believe in, but we have to be good at believing in what we really believe in, because that's going to be making a big difference. That's going to be helping us a lot. It's going to help a lot of the functions. And the most important immune organ in the body is our brain. It's not anywhere else. It's not the white blood cells. It's not anything like that. The brain is going to tell us a lot of our organs how to function, so what to do, how to respond. And if we have a very depressed condition, we're going to have problems. But if we are optimistic, if we are relaxed, if we feel good, if we have confidence, and we are going to function better, and we're going to be breathing better and producing better immune response, and we're going to be helping our body. And I see people with cancer, and of course I tell people it'd be dumb if I would ask anybody with cancer, don't worry. Of course you're worried, but you have to. I always say, don't worry full time.
Love that. Don't worry full time. Y'all, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the voice of Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez with the BioCare Hospital in Tijuana, Mexico. We've got a new segment we're doing here on Center Stage Talk called 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. He is the new Dr. Oz of Center Stage, and we are loving every minute of it. We have got so much ground to catch up on, Dr. Rodriguez. It's not funny. I've got so many questions here. I want to know about shingles. You know, until recently, probably, I don't know, maybe the commercial started running on TV about a year ago about shingles. That was something that you rarely ever heard before. Now there's commercials on TV and says, and basically I think the commercial says something to the gist that if you've ever had chicken pox, you carry the shingles virus in your system. So if you're of a certain age, then you're more likely to contract shingles. What is that all about? Is that true?
Well, in many ways, unfortunately, yes, it's true. We're seeing more and more shingles. But that's exactly one of the things that we're talking about. If you ask people with shingles, people that develop shingles at older age, and you ask them, tell me about your life. Tell me what happened just about the time where the shingles develop. They're going to give you a story that's not going to be a nice story. They're going to tell you about the loss of a family member, loss of something, financial disruption, any sort of a problem, because with stress, with this type of stress, shingles are to follow. It's common, and I've seen it very many times, that people come here because the husband has cancer, and shortly after, the wife develops shingles.
Wow.
It's a manifestation of an immune system that's getting depressed. And so many times when I see people, when you can tell, I mean, you can tell the wife or the husband or the children how much are into all this situation, and I immediately start saying, okay, you need to supplement, you need to do this, you need to do like vitamin C. Vitamin C in good amounts can actually stop progression of viruses. So if people are under a lot of stress, yes, vitamin C is helpful. It's going to be helpful, and it's going to be harmless. So I always say, well, why don't you do it? Just get your vitamin C. You can buy it anywhere, and just get a good amount of vitamin C and get your juices and your orange juice and your lime juice and all these things. To help you, and again, all these high-colored fruits and vegetables in order to help your immune system to fight off this condition so you don't get to have it. You see, but it's very common, and it's very common on people, for example, that have serious diseases, that shingles come around, and not because the cancer or because the disease brought the shingles, but because the depression produce the shingles. But if you know, I mean, people in the audience tonight, if anybody knows anybody that has recently developed shingles, I invite them to go and talk to this person and see what happened. What happened in their lives before this shingle came around? And we learn. When we talk to people, we learn. I think it's very important that when we go and talk to people, we have to learn more about their lives and so forth, because we learn about our own lives. And I love, when I talk to patients, I love to talk about them, and I love to talk about their families and their things that they're looking forward to. That helps a lot. I mean, I've seen people with very serious diseases that are looking forward to this huge event, to their 50th wedding anniversary, to the wedding of a daughter, things like this. And you see them really holding on because they want to get to this milestone. They want to be there. They want to walk their daughter through the aisle on their wedding. There are many things that that people can do when they have this drive, this forward thing that they're looking to happen, and that can be very helpful. On the contrary, when you don't have any of that, when you don't have any drive in your life, shingles might be one of the things that come your way.
Wow. If you just tuned in, again, you're listening to the voice of Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. He's going to be doing a regular segment here on Center Stage called 24/7 Healthcare with Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. If you have a question or a comment, you can get on the phone lines now and dial us up at 347-850-8390. Don't be shy. Dr. Rodriguez is answering questions I have had in the back of my mind for years, and I'm so glad he's here tonight answering them. So if you've got one about yourself or a loved one, any kind of questions concerning health, exercise, diet, Dr. Rodriguez can help you tonight. Listen, Dr. Rodriguez, one thing that I've been curious about is colon cleanses, and there's something called an ionic foot soak. You know, people are trying different ways now to clean toxins out of their body and clean their colon. Let's start off talking about colon cleanses. Are they safe, and which ones should people be using if they are safe?
Well, there are many things that you can use to keep your bowel in good shape. But where does colon cleansing come from? It comes from instinctive knowledge. This comes from forever. You see, if you go back in medicine, probably hundreds of years, mm-hmm. you're going to find that colon cleansing was one of the things that we did. The idea of using a purge, an enema. Mm-hmm. All those things were very much imprinted in people's mind. And again, if you go and ask your mother, and you say, "Mom, did my grandmother ever give you an enema?" You're probably going to get a yes for answer, because it used to be, up to very recently, one of the ways where you treat a child that had any sort of intestinal discomfort. And that's where the idea of colon cleansing comes from. And we have just brought it to newer times, and the idea of doing an enema for whatever reason doesn't sound as appealing today as it used to be, mm-hmm. so people don't do it really anymore that much. But in many cases, yes, people will continue doing or do colonics and things like that, but we have resorted to other sorts of colon cleansers, which in general are either purge or a fiber, or high fiber product. Well, all these things, they do make a sense. We actually in the hospital use enemas as one of the ways to detoxify and to help to speed up recovery.
Really?
Because of the diet that we take. If we were going to ask everybody listening tonight, how many people consider themselves to be constipated, chronically constipated? I would say probably at least half, because we all have bowel problems. We all have bloating. We all have all these sort of things, and we have to fix it. Now, the best way to do it, of course, and the most natural way to do it, is by using high fiber products. One of them, for example, is hyssop. Hyssop, there are products that are made with hyssop that is very helpful. It's a little bit of a perch and a little bit of fiber. The psyllium, that's in many commercial products, that's also a very safe way to do it. Psyllium is very good. Bran is another very good one. One of the things that I absolutely love and I recommend to people is just plain olive oil.
Mm.
And if you're not the type of person that's going to take a full spoonful of oil and take it because it might be a little bit disgusting, well, what about doing what Italian restaurants do? Why don't you put a small saucer, put a good amount of olive oil, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and soak your bread in it and eat it. That's going to be a very gourmet way to take your olive oil, and it's going to make a difference. The other thing that you can do is products that are very high in fiber and very high in enzymes. The best, absolutely the best, pineapple. Get a fresh pineapple, cut it in small pieces, and take a certain amount every day in the evening.
Mm.
You got tired of the pineapple, then go to papaya.
Mm.
By the way, when you get the papaya, take the seeds, put them on a little bottle, keep them in the fridge, and when you eat your papaya because of this problem, or even if you don't eat the papaya every day, take a few seeds, 10, 12, 15 of the seeds of the papaya, and drink them with water as if they were capsules. They're loaded with enzymes, and they can also help to detoxify your bowel. So
what?
All these things are ways to do it. Again, barley is another good way to do it. But all of these things are going to be helping you to keep your bowel clean. What do we mean by that? That you keep regular bowel movements that are going to be working in good situation, so you're never stuck with anything.
How many bowel movements are you supposed to have per day?
It really varies person to person, but I would say if you're not getting at least one a day, you have a problem. But you should have between one and two a day.
Okay.
More than that, just depends on the diet. But one, two a day, that should be the normal. And the other thing that we must not forget when we're talking about colon cleansing and regularity and so forth,
mm-hmm.
is plain water.
Oh, yeah.
How much?
How much? Two quarts.
Two quarts of water a day.
Up and above, a minimum of two quarts, up and above whatever else you drink. Because many people tell me, but you know what, doctor? I took, like this morning, I took a juice, then I took a soda pop, then I took a coffee, then I took a cup of tea. So I'm taking my fluids. No, you're not doing enough, because water goes to your body to dissolve and carry substances from the inside of the body to the kidney and out of your body. You see, so if you're taking things that already have things in solution, like the coffee, like the soda, like the tea that already has sugar and things in it, you're just doing a partial work.
Are we talking about a certain kind of water? Are we talking alkaline water, pure water? What kind of water?
I would say good quality spring water. Alkaline water is fine, but water.
Okay,
I mean, it has to be water without anything in it, without any sugar, any sweetener, anything like that.
Okay. Another thing, clarify, when we talked about psyllium earlier, when you're taking psyllium in large amounts, don't you need acidophilus to put the good bacteria back in?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because psyllium is not necessarily going to remove the good bacteria. Actually, good bacteria eat some of that psyllium and produce good substances. So when you put fiber and bacteria together, you're doing a good thing for your body.
Right. You know, a lot of people are talking about those ionic foot soaks. I don't know if y'all are familiar with those. If you're not, you can Google it. But I've done them quite often, and I wasn't sure how safe they were, but I did notice a difference. And you'll have to, you know, kind of clarify if I'm really, is it in my head or did it really happen? But it looks like when I've done the ionic foot soaks, and y'all, for those of you who are not familiar with those, that's when you take your feet and they put this machine inside like a tub of water, and you put your feet in between this machine, and they put a little salt in there, and supposedly after about 30 minutes, it draws out the toxins out of your body. First of all, Dr. Rodriguez, do you believe in them? And if you do, how often should you do it?
Okay. I'm not sure, but it's not a matter of belief. I'm not sure I absolutely agree with what sort of a benefit it gets. However, just like you're telling me, I know many people that are very happy doing it. I don't see anything bad with it, and if it works for you, I would say go for it.
Okay.
Because there are many things that we do that, again, just making you feel better, it's going to be very beneficial. Now, soaking your feet in water, no matter what else, is going to be beneficial. I wish people did it a lot more often. And if you did it every day, there is no problem with it, and I think there is always going to be some sort of a benefit. To what extent that possibly be part of the question, I cannot answer.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Another thing, a lot of people are doing gastric bypass surgeries. Are those safe, and do you recommend them? If you're, like, over, you know, weight and maybe 100 pounds or better, do you recommend gastric bypass?
I don't recommend it. Definitely, I don't recommend it. Of course, you have people that get to the 300-pound type of thing and so forth,
right,
where your choice is, well, you let them die like that or you do a bypass. And in those cases, you say, okay, yes, I'm going to do it, but I'm not convinced that it's going to be a good thing. And actually, people that do this sort of surgery, well, they're happy in the beginning, but usually in the long term, they have a lot of problems because gastric bypass surgery, of course, is going to handicap the absorption of a lot of nutrients, and it's going to give you problems with time. You have to be more careful about your health care, et cetera, your vitamin intake, your supplementation. And there's a point where you have to do it. It's not a choice. It's an absolute necessity in some sort of people. Now, people that do this sort of thing just because they want to do it for cosmetic reasons, I absolutely do not recommend it.
Gotcha. Vaccines. Are vaccines safe, and do you recommend them?
Let's go back a little bit in time again. I think there are many vaccines that have proven to be a blessing to mankind, okay, like smallpox. Smallpox used to damage and kill millions of people in the world. Now it has been completely eradicated out of the face of the earth, which is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the same with polio and probably with rabies. The problem I see today is that we're developing a lot of vaccines very fast.
Yeah.
By fast, I mean probably without enough testing, and putting them out there to be used by all our children for diseases that might not be as pressing as the ones that I have already mentioned. And that's one of my problems. The other problem I have is that they do too many. And my question is, how overwhelming can it be for a child to get 15 different vaccines? Are we really doing something good, or are we doing something overwhelming? And to me, to make it short, I think we're still experimenting to see what are going to be the results. So I'm not very fond of vaccination as it's done today, but I would definitely endorse some forms of vaccination of all these very deadly diseases that have been time-tested over many, many years and have given good results to mankind. I would do that. But the amount of vaccines that they do nowadays, I'm not convinced that neither that they have the quality nor the experience to be applied the way they are being applied. I think there would have to be a lot more research before they press us to have so many vaccines in such a short time to our babies.
Okay. I want to touch on two things real quick, too. How to build a strong immune system, and what are your thoughts on flu shots? Because, you know, a couple of years ago we heard about the H1N1, and they told everybody go out and get a shot. You know, you got to have it, or, you know, this bird flu is going to come in here and it's going to kill us all. And a lot of people went out and did it. Now, I'm not fond of flu shots. I don't take them. I didn't take that H1N1 shot. What do you think of those flu vaccinations, which here in the States, you could almost get a flu shot at a bus stop? I mean, that's just how easy it is to access a flu shot. What are your thoughts?
Okay, I'm just going to answer very fast two things. I didn't take the H1N1 vaccine.
Really?
I don't take flu shots. Okay.
Oh.
And the reason is exactly what I was telling you before. I mean, we have like the H1N1 virus situation. And a month later, or 2 months later, people tell you we have a vaccine. And my question is, how tested is that vaccine?
Wow.
I mean, this is just beginning, and we already have a vaccine. I mean, there are things that do not add in my head. How could you develop a vaccine in such a short period of time? One.
What?
Second, I know as a physician that the virus that hits me today is going to be different than the one that's going to hit me this fall. And the one that's going to hit me this fall is going to be different from the following spring. So what am I supposed to do, which is actually what they're doing? Getting a shot every 6 months for a different type of strand, because that's the one they think is going to strike next time? I don't think so. I don't want to do it. And I don't want to expose myself to that sort of situation. And I normally tell people my best defense would be, in this sort of case, my own immunity.
Mm.
Number one, I'm going to give you a very good, it's probably the best tool to avoid the next flu season. One, wash your hands. Wash your hands as frequent as you can. The transmission of viruses during the flu season is not done through the air, unless you're definitely standing in front of some people and that person coughs on your face or sneezes on your face. Apart from that situation, it's not going to come from viruses flying in the air, because the viruses are going to die shortly after they're expelled from the body. They're going to go to a surface, last for a certain time, and then die. So when we hold a handrail, when we exchange money, when we walk around, if we touch anything and then scratch our eyes or our nose or our mouth, which we do instinctively, we don't think of those things. So we don't have to say, I'm not going to do it. We're going to end up doing it. And so what we have to do is wash our hands as frequent as we can. Then again, I would go for my vitamin C. I would go for my healthy type of diet. I remember, for example, my mother. My father was an accountant. My mother was a housewife. I was fortunate enough to have a full-time housewife when I was a kid. And my mother was very instinctive, as many mothers used to be. And I remember my mother, for example, a certain part of the year would say, you know, we're approaching flu season. So I'm going to give you more fish. I'm going to give you lemonade. I'm going to give you honey. I'm going to give you certain things. And she would do all these things consistently that we had to do because flu was coming and she wanted us to be stronger. And I think that's something that we have to keep on doing, learning about those simple things, because they seem to do the best job. Wash our hands, because we're very close to a lot of individuals nowadays, and the possibility of picking up something with our hands is very high. And then we touch the eye, the nose, or the mouth, and we're putting it directly into a mucosa where the virus is going to enter very easy. The virus is not going to go through the skin, definitely not. It needs to be carried to some open area, and those are the best places are the, those three, eyes, nose, and mouth. So let's wash our hands frequently. Let's use some of those fluids that you use to cleanse your hands. Those are also advisable. And let's keep all these things under control. And I'm sure that we're going to be a lot better. But again, I don't take those shots. I don't believe that's going to be the answer.
Okay. You know, Doctor, here in the States, and I don't know what the procedures over there are, but, you know, it used to be a colonoscopy or a mammogram, you know, you could take every year. Now the rules are changing. Unless you have a history in your family, you know, they're seeing 5 years, 10 years out for these type tests. What is your gut on what a woman or a man or whoever you know feels like if you know they feel that they need these tests, should they push to go get them even if they have to do it at their own expense, or should they really just take the doctor's recommendation and wait 5 and 10 years on some of these tests?
Well, on the case of the breast, I think nothing beats self-examination.
Okay.
And we should learn about it. We should know how to do it and just learn this technique. It's very simple. If you Google all this breast exploration, you're going to find how to do it. And you and that's going to be probably one of the best ways to do it.
And that's male and female for mammograms, right? I mean, breast examination.
That would be for mammograms.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, mammograms are not the best, I mean, the perfect answer either, because many women that have had the mammograms and turned out negative and later on came with a cancer, that's not a very pleasant surprise. So we have to learn to self-explore and to be aware of all these things. And again, this is another condition that worries me. We're watching of breast cancer in younger and younger women. So teaching younger women to how to do it is very important. Now, with colon, again, we have to watch our bowel movement habits, see how often we go. If we have any question about on whether this is working okay or not working okay, go to the doctor and press for colonoscopy or for any other sort of study just to make sure that nothing is there. And you know what? I hate to say this, but many times if your doctor says no, and I think it's mainly because of financial reasons, they don't want to pay for as many studies as they used to. But if we say, look, I have reasons to believe this and I want you to record all my symptoms, because I want to be able to use this information in the future if something happens,
mm-hmm.
That's going to open the doctor's ears, and he'll probably say, okay, let's check it out. Because you're already making a statement that he reported to you a fear of a problem, and he's not taking action upon it. And I have done this with many people that have called and say, look, I have this problem, what should I do? Well, just tell the doctor that you want to record the fact,
mm-hmm.
just in case something happens later. And sure enough, they say, okay, let's check it out.
That makes a lot of sense. You promised earlier to talk to us about salt intake. What is the safe amount of salt intake daily?
Going back in time again.
Okay.
I graduated from medical school in 1968.
Wow.
In 1968... When people were with heart disease and high blood pressure, they would tell us you have to reduce the salt intake to about 2 grams a day. That's a low amount of salt. Why? Because we used to take about 5 to 6 grams a day. So 2 grams were about half to a third of the amount of salt intake. Right now, if you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you you have to take less salt and you say how much salt, the doctor will probably propose 5 to 6 grams a day, mm-hmm. which is what used to be the normal. Mm. And that's because right now we're eating about 14, 15 grams a day of salt every day. And that's really a very serious problem. We're eating far too much salt. Why? Because salt is in everything. There's virtually no way we can reduce salt intake if we take the average American diet. If you open any product, if you read the label of any packed product, whether it's a can, frozen, or a pack, and you look for the word sodium, sodium is the culprit, you're going to find it. Even if you're buying Jell-O, or whether if you're buying marmalade, even if it's a sweet, you're going to find salt in it. You're going to find the word sodium something. Why? Because it's very good for flavor and because it makes a very good preservative. So they're putting salt in just about every single thing that we eat if it's processed foods. So that makes for a very high intake of salt. And we're seeing more and more health problems because of this high salt intake. One of them, of course, is high blood pressure. The other one is heart disease and even cancer. I mean, high intake of sodium is considered to be a carcinogen. Mm. We shouldn't have that much sodium in our lives. We should have a lot more potassium. Potassium is the natural ion of living things. Sodium is not. And sodium and potassium have the same electrical charge, so one displaces the other. So if we take too much sodium, we get rid of the potassium. Now, where's potassium? Because it's the ion of life. It's going to be in all living things that we eat. It's going to be in a fruit, it's going to be in a vegetable, it's going to be in anything that we eat that's alive. So eating, again, if we have a tendency to a vegan diet, and again, I have to insist, I'm not telling people to be vegetarian. I'm telling them to be more careful, more rational about the type of food. I mean, a 16-ounce steak is not on anybody's benefit. And if we read the Bible, which I tell people many times, you know what? Go back and open the Bible and go back to Leviticus. Read Leviticus with a different mind. Stop thinking a little bit about religion and think a little bit about health. And you're going to find in Leviticus a lot of good advice that's going to let you know our rules for nutrition, our rules for healthy living that you're going to find in there. And if you read carefully, you're going to see that meats were for festivities. Mm. I mean, you didn't have beef for everyday meal. And you ate natural fats like olive oil, even lard, which I don't have anything against it. But they didn't use any artificial oils. They didn't have a high salt intake. They ate a lot of fresh, natural foods. And they only kept certain foods for certain occasions. So that was the smart way to do it. And that's in the Bible, and people can read about it, learn about it. And there's a book that I like a lot that's called the Diet Bible. Mm-hmm. That refers to a lot of things, the way we should do it according to how the Bible talks about food. But what we have to do, in summary, is we have to get a different relationship between our bodies and the foods that we take. Because the foods that we take are going to change the way we feel, are going to change the way we function, are going to change our longevity, and more importantly, how well performing we're going to be in the future and how much advantage we can take of being on this world with the people that we love. Enjoy them and let them enjoy us.
Dr. Rodriguez, tell us, you know, I had surgery a couple years ago, and I'm a woman, yo, so you know how women, you want to be perfect even though you're about to go under the knife. And I had my nails done, and the minute I got to pre-surgery, they took the nail polish off, and they said, we need to look at your nails, you know, your fingernails and your toenails. What was the purpose of, why do they need to look at your fingernails and your toenails prior to a surgery? And tell us what does that mean? What is that about? What do they find when they look at your toenails and your fingernails?
Well, that's something that you can do if you... Do you have polish right now on any of your nails?
I don't have polish on right now.
You don't have polish right now. Okay, so anyone that's listening to us, put your finger under light and put your index finger under one of your fingers and your thumb at the tip of the nail. And apply a little bit of pressure, like if you were putting pressure between the two fingers, between your index and your thumb,
mm-hmm.
Taking any of your fingers. And mm-hmm. you're going to see how the blood stops flowing under the nail.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see how it becomes white.
Mm-hmm.
Then you let go, and you see how the pinkish color returns immediately.
Oh.
Okay. That's going to tell me how good the blood flow is in your body. It's very old. It goes back probably to the Greeks and Egyptians. But when you have a person with a problem and you do that, you produce that white, and when you let go, it takes a long time to come back. That tells me the blood is not really flowing. Also, if it changes from pink to bluish, I know you have a problem. We have an oxygenation problem.
Ooh.
So it's a very simple way to do it. That's why they normally take away polish both from toes and hands, because many times the anesthesiologist is giving you the anesthesia, of course, in your head, walks around the table, and when he goes by your fingers, he might stop a little bit, and just by touching at your toes and looking at that little thing, he can tell how good your circulation and your oxygenation is.
Wow. Okay, I learned something. Wow. I didn't know why they did it, and I think I was a little too nervous to ask at that time, but now I know.
They should have explained you. That's one of the things I don't like about the medical profession. I think people, we should take a couple of minutes to explain people why. Because you're right. If you're a woman and you have your polish, I understand that you like to keep it in that way. And if I'm going to take off that polish, I have to tell you why.
Yes.
So you understand that that's going to put you a lot more at ease and
yes.
helpful and everything. You're going to be part of the team. That's very important. We have lost the team feeling when we talk about healthcare. And we have to make a team. And the patient, the person that has the disease, is part of the team, should be thoroughly informed, should be thoroughly brought into the team so people can understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. Because it's very important.
I so agree. Dr. Rodriguez, my final question. They say if you have a stroke, that you're going to have a second and a third and whatever, I guess, until you finally leave here. Is that true? Is there truth to that?
If you have a stroke, I have two simple advices. One of them, in the shortest time possible after stroke, give the person that suffered it melatonin. Mm-hmm. Melatonin is the substance that you can buy in any health food store that people normally buy to sleep or for jet lag. It's very simple. It's very harmless. It's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
And people that take that seem to do much better after the stroke. That's one. The other one is vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because vitamin E improves the blood flow, and it's a strong antioxidant that's going to diminish the damage to the brain. Again, things that your doctor will probably not tell you, but doing vitamin E and melatonin can be helpful when you have a stroke. And the vitamin E can actually prevent a second or a third stroke. So, so that's important to know. So
wow.
you can talk to your doctor the minute you have it. I know doctors are very hesitant to use vitamins or natural remedies. And unless there is a clear objection to doing the vitamin E, it can be very helpful. But the melatonin practically will give you, it practically has no possible objections about doing it.
And if you get to the hospital within a certain period of time after having the stroke, is it true that it can be reversed?
The shorter time between the stroke and you going to the doctor, your chances are going to improve. Most definitely. Because the stroke is the first symptom, but the big problem is when it sets in, the damage that happens to the brain. So if you can restore circulation to the damaged area, the faster you do that, the better off you're going to be.
Wow. Y'all, this has been a really informative 2 hours. Dr. Rodriguez, you're the best. I've had a great time asking you all these questions and learning so much about how to be a healthier person. Tell anyone who may want to reach out to you via telephone, via your website, via your email, how they can contact you.
Okay. Our website, which is something that I love because it's very easy and they can put an email there for me. I answer all my questions personally. It's www.biocarehospital.com. B as in boy, bio, B-I-O-C-A-R-E, hospital.com. That would be the best way. We have an 800 number, 701-7345. And my email, my personal email is doctor@biocarehospital.com.
And Dr. Rodriguez, is it true now if you're in the States and you want to seek treatment at BioCare Hospital, there are arrangements that you can help them make to make that happen and then also have transportation to meet them, I believe it is in San Diego, and take them from there straight to the hospital?
Absolutely. We meet all our patients at San Diego Airport. We bring them down. We have some international patients that come, for example, to Los Angeles, and we again meet them at the airport, drive them to their room, and we take care of them from the beginning to the end. And yes, if they give us a call or if they send us an email, we're going to be very helpful. We have people that are very good at helping them to make all the arrangements.
And I think I read on your website that you'll have someone to meet them that is bilingual, so they don't have to worry about translation problems and that type of thing.
The whole hospital is bilingual.
Wonderful.
I mean, from the cleaning people to the nurses to the doctors to the drivers, everybody is bilingual.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Rodriguez, thank you so much for being my guest tonight. I've learned so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I love to talk to people, and thank you for making that possible.
Thank you. Yeah, that was Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. I have learned so much, and I believe anyone who was listening tonight, y'all had to learn something as well. Listen, y'all, reminder, we do this each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. These are the kind of topics we want to bring. Topics where you can learn more about being a better and a healthier you. Also, a reminder, y'all, if you'd like to hear us do different type shows here, if you have some show ideas, Drop us a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Or if you'd like to share a news tip, we'd love to hear it. Also drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. In closing, again, I'd like to thank Dr. Rodrigo Rodriguez. I have enjoyed this last hour so much. And I'd like to say thank you to the audience for listening. Follow us on Facebook. Y'all, Center Stage is on Facebook and also on Twitter. Follow us. Thank you, everyone, tonight for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.